in his hand now, rolling it back and forth with his fingers. "I've met him before," he said. "True, but that meeting was absent the present facts." Van Damme glanced at a scratch pad on the desk. RSMC Tokyo clocks Typhoon Caitlin with sustained winds of 105 miles an hour, and she's showing rapid intensification. "I don't think we're supposed to call them she anymore." Van Damme rolled his eyes. "If this genderless storm with a female name makes landfall anywhere near the Kanto Plain, Japan might be a little busy with recovery efforts to host the G20. "True," Ryan said. "The evidence against Joe is mounting," Van Damme said. "And what we do have is pretty damned, well, damning. I know you want to meet him, shake his hand, get what you believe is a true measure of the man, but that might not be possible. Jack, you may well have to make a decision on Joe without looking him in the eye." Chapter 45. Yukiko's apartment was on the fourth floor of a tidy but older brick building a block and a half to the northeast of the Palacio Duhao Hyatt, where the Chinese foreign minister was staying. Buenos Aires City Police and members of Foreign Minister Lee's protective detail had barricaded both ends of Avenida Alvear in front of the hotel and Posadas behind, forcing the campus operators to approach the Koan Chosocho operatives' room from Libertador. On the other side of Libertador was the train yard. 500 meters beyond that were the slums of Villa 31, and presumably, Vincent Chen's little band of terrorists. Chavez placed a call to John Clark as they walked, asking him to check with his contacts in the Japanese intelligence community to see if any of them could verify a Monzaki Yukiko. He was still waiting to hear back when they arrived in front of the building. The single apartment elevator was old-world style, with a wooden door and an accordion gate that had to be shut manually before the car would operate. There was only enough room inside for four at a time, so Chavez, Ryan, and Adara squeezed in with the Japanese woman, leaving Midas to bound up the stairs. The car chugged upward slowly with the weight of four passengers, and the former Delta commander was leaning against a plaster-covered wall when Jack pushed open the door. "You're staying alone?" Chavez asked again. Yukiko held up her little finger, bending it at the knuckle. "Yubikiri," she said. "I promise." Midas and Adara went through the door first, clearing the room before allowing Yukiko inside. "I guess you really weren't expecting company," Midas said when he came back to the door. "You're as messy as my young friend." Chavez's phone buzzed. He answered it, nodded a few times, and then motioned for Yukiko to hold up her right hand, thumb extended. She did, revealing a crescent scar on the web. "Looks like it's her," Chavez said. "Thanks, Mr. C." Yukiko smiled. "Mr. C? My father knew a man named John who was sometimes called that." Chavez winked at the others in the group. "That's what Mr. C said." It took more than a phone call to be completely accepted, but the fact that John Clark apparently knew her father put Monzaki Yukiko well on the road. The IC world was often a multi-generational affair, with children following parents into the business. Clearances could be somewhat easier to obtain when a relative had already been scrutinized to the nth degree during a security background check. Free now to move as she pleased without getting shot, Yukiko wasted no time in retrieving a spare mobile phone from a bag on her dresser and dialing up what was presumably a GSM bug like the ones campus operators often deployed. All of them were accustomed to the boredom of monitoring a bug and took up comfortable positions around the small efficiency apartment. Yukiko sat on a cramped love seat beside Adara, elbows on her knees. Midas and Ding took up positions in the two wood slat chairs covered with quilted pillows, while Jack sat on the edge of the hastily made bed. The device was active, picking up the periodic clang of pots or the sound of someone belching. "Kitchen?" Adara asked. Yukiko nodded. "The microphone is directly against the window. Cheap glass is very good at conducting sound. There is a large table approximately 5 feet from the wall. If Chen holds a meeting, there is a good chance it will be at that table. Jack rubbed a hand over the top of his head. I don't get it, Yukiko. What's the Japanese connection? Please call me Yuki, she said. That is a very good question. Have you heard of Chongryon?
Sounds Korean, Jack said.
Chavez nodded. Isn't that the political arm of the DPRK in Japan?
Precisely that, Yuki said.
My organization has linked members of Chongryon to acts of espionage in Japan. Kim Soo, a Korean woman with strong ties to this group, is one of Vincent Chen's many paramours. My research leads me to believe Chen has many female contacts around the world. Amanda Salazar as a case in point. He is quite charming, but mixing work with pleasure will be his eventual downfall. I would not have been aware of Vincent Chen if he'd had better taste in women.
Midas took a deep breath.
This is a cruddy thing to bring up, but it impacts operational security. If we're working together now, we need to know about the blonde who was shot.
Yuki tilted her head to the side, her face passive.
Beatriz Campos was also from Paraguay. She was a known assassin and a terrorist, already convicted in absentia for the murder of 2 Japanese businessmen during a visit to Peru. My organization believes Kim Soo is complicit in a plot to disrupt the upcoming G20 summit. I was sent here to follow her and glean any useful intelligence. Suspicions against Kim are just that, suspicions. But the evidence against Beatriz Campos is irrefutable. I had no idea she would be here, but when I found out, I simply seized the opportunity.
Midas pressed the issue. So you carry the suppressed .22 caliber rifle around, just in case?
Another fair question, the Japanese woman said. There must be trust if we are to work together. Were the intelligence on Kim to reach a high enough standard, I would contact my superiors with the information, and then proceed as ordered. Such orders may include the use of a rifle.
She shrugged. Your country has been known to put the faces of certain high-value targets on playing cards.
The group nodded. Midas said, targets indeed.
High-value indeed. Yuki said. Beatriz Campos was not our ace of spades. She was, however, an ace.
Less than 600 meters away, at the Palacio Duhao Hyatt, Chinese Foreign Minister Li reclined barefoot and shirtless on a blue velvet duchesse brise, his legs propped on a thick pillow on the elongated footstool. The room had a distinct French neoclassical style with clawfoot furniture, wing-backed chairs, and the broken duchess style of chaise longue, where Li was undergoing a thorough examination from his physician. The bespectacled Dr. Ren used a pair of tweezers to pick bits of wood and gypsum wallboard from Li's shoulder. He would not have been injured at all had the idiot Paraguayan woman not been so slow to detonate the device. Her stupidity would have infuriated him, but the minor shrapnel wounds would only enhance the story of the cowardly attempt on his life. The death of one of the members of his security detail and the injury of another should have been enough, but you played the hand you were dealt. Lee's mobile phone began to buzz across the ornate glass-topped table at the foot of the Duchesse Brise. He shot a glance at Long Yun, who looked down at the number and then picked it up without answering.
Madame Li, Long said.
The foreign minister nodded and held out his hand, causing the doctor to stab him with the tweezers. Li cursed at the idiot and shoved him away, ordering him out of the room before taking the phone.
Wei, Shingan Baobei, he said.
Hello, sweetheart.
No, I am fine. Minor scratches, that is all.
No, really.
I am well.
Please tell our son not to worry. He must be brave and take care of his mother.
Journalists from Xinhua, reporting directly to Secretary Deng's propaganda department, would speak with Madame Li shortly. The foreign minister knew his wife well enough to be sure that she would quote her selfless husband, who, though wounded in a foreign land, exhorted their son to be brave and take care of his mother. He felt the pang of guilt at using his family so cruelly, but quickly disabused himself of the feelings. Drastic actions were necessary for the survival of the party, perhaps even for China itself. "Yes, my dear," he continued to console his wife. "They are taking good care of me. I will be home very soon. Yes, my love. I must hang up now." He did not actually end the call first. Such an act would have proven disastrous. Even a man as powerful as the foreign minister of China knew to let his wife be the one to end the call. She finally did, and Li handed the phone off to Long Yun. The CSB officer set it back on the table. "Will we go forward, Mr. Foreign Minister?" "Of course," Li said. "Why would we not?" "I am fine. We have come too far to turn back now." Colonel Long nodded toward a flat-screen television across the room. The sound was off, but the photos showed the whirling white vortex of a typhoon on a large map that included Taiwan, Japan, and the East China Sea. "The typhoon has turned northward," Long said. "It may prove problematic if it reaches Japan." "Nonsense," Li said. "The summit is still days away. Many things will occur between now and then. Now get that egg of a doctor back in here." Li knew all too well that there were countless things that could go wrong with his scheme. This typhoon, the unknown person who would shot Amanda's blonde compatriot, even idiot servants who were dilatory in their duties. President Zhou might suddenly realize that Li was not actually his best friend. No, the man was much too dense for that. And even if Zhou did come to that conclusion, he would have to grow a pair of testicles in order to do anything about it. Perhaps by then the President of the United States would have used his famous Ryan Doctrine to put an end to Zhou and his witch hunt for anyone in the party who had exhibited a shred of financial success. And if President Ryan was himself too dense, then there was always another way. In truth, Li had begun to think of their cause as a noble one, just as Chairman Mao must have seen the task that had been before him. A work of the gods, or in a world absent any gods, at least the work of destiny. "Maybe they turned in for the night," Chavez said. "Perhaps," Yuki said. "More likely, they are upset about the death of Beatrice Campos." Jack rubbed a hand across his beard. Talk of the sewers had left him feeling like he needed another shower. "How long will the battery last on your device?" "The microphone is voice-activated," she said. "That will conserve some power, but I am afraid we have no more than 36 hours. "We'll listen in shifts, then," Chavez said. "Jack, you're voluntold to take the first rotation." "Excellent," Ryan said through a feigned smile. "I will listen with him," Yuki said, "to make certain he does not drift off to sleep." Midas stood and raised his arms high overhead in a long, shuddering stretch. "I call dibs on half the bed." Adara stuck out her bottom lip in a mock pout. "What happened to guys taking the couch?" "I only called half the bed," Midas said. "You can find Ding for the other half." "I'm good on the floor," Chavez said, dragging the cushions off his chair. Midas fell back on the mattress, bouncing once before curling up in the sheet, apparently unfazed that Yuki had slept in it the night before. He'd surely slept in much, much worse. "Don't try anything," he said without opening his eyes as Adara got in beside him. "I'll do my best to contain myself," she said. Chavez was already breathing deeply. "I like your friends," Yuki said, looking at Jack, who now sat beside her on the love seat. "Me too," Ryan said. He wanted to ask her about the scratches on her face, but decided against it. He was surrounded by people he trusted, and was alive after a particularly bloody day. A little mystery was a good thing. Chapter 46.
John Clark was nothing if not patient. He'd seen Magdalena's auction video in the room at Matarife's ranch. It had sickened him enough to make it his mission to find the one who'd brought her to the States, the person who had used her and then quite literally sold her into slavery. According to Lupe, that person was Dorian Palmetto. Clark had a nose for bad men like Palmetto, but even so, it took 2 days of watchful waiting to find him. Lupe had given him the location of the cheap hotel where Palmetto liked to hang out and a vague physical description, but Clark still didn't know exactly what he looked like. He considered the idea of calling in a favor with an old friend from the agency, or even getting Gavin to pull the guy's photo. In the end, though, he decided he didn't want any kind of trail, even with trusted friends. As it turned out, in addition to running a side business trafficking in human cargo, Palmetto had a real job managing an auto parts store near the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base in West Fort Worth. Navy C-40 Clippers and Air Force Reserve C-130s had replaced the iconic B-52 Stratofortresses of Clark's day when it had been a strategic air command base. Air Force F-16s and an occasional Navy F-A-18 Hornet roared overhead, invigorating Clark and helping rather than hindering his thinking process. Clark was a traditionalist when it came to investigation, preferring well-worn shoe leather and telephoto lenses over computer analysis. But even he didn't have any trouble learning that there were three people named Dorian Palmetto on Facebook, and one of them had graduated from Arlington Heights High School, also in West Fort Worth. It was a dangerous endeavor to see stereotypes in the world of intelligence gathering. Yet looking at the smarmy mug of Palmetto's profile picture, Clark couldn't help thinking that he would have shot this guy had he ever approached one of his daughters. Shooting him certainly wasn't outside the realm of possibility now. According to his profile, Dorian was married with two children, both boys. His wife was a slender waif of a thing, with freckles and braids that, not incidentally, made her look like she was in junior high school. It made Clark sick to his stomach to contemplate her horrible life. It was all based on a lie, and she went to sleep every night with no idea she was married to a monster. Or it was a living hell. Either way, that was about to change. Clark knew there was a way to get GPS locations from photos on Facebook. He'd heard Gavin talk about it. But again, he decided to watch and wait. He had the address of the Autosphere where Palmetto worked, and of the sleep-tight inn tucked in off Loop 820, where, according to Lupe, he took new girls to break them in. The chain-smoking woman with peroxide orange hair behind the front desk hadn't given Clark a second look when he checked into the sleep-tight inn the day before. She was evidently used to older, single men in dark glasses who paid cash and kept to themselves. For a $200 deposit, a little over 4 nights' rent, she didn't make him show any ID. Clark had stayed in worse places, though that had been many years ago, and Viet Cong soldiers had been trying to kill him at the time. All the rooms in this single-floor motel faced the parking lot, and Clark's room, the last one on the short leg of the L-shaped building, gave him a decent view of all the doors but the two adjacent to his. The walls were thin enough that he could hear if anyone came or went in the next room. But no one ever did. Palmetto's Facebook photos showed that he drove a blue Dodge Durango with damage to the right front fender. Clark woke up to peek out the window and find the Durango parked across the lot. But by the time he got his pants on and slipped the 1911 into his holster, it was gone. It didn't matter. He'd always been patient, and years of hunting men had endowed him with even more of that particular virtue. Now that Lupe's information was confirmed, Clark had no doubt that Palmetto would return. Clark made it a habit to carry a couple Clif bars in his bag, but when Palmetto still hadn't shown by late evening, the chocolate chip and peanut butter washed down with Diet Pepsi from the motel vending machine was wearing thin.
He reasoned that Palmetto was a predator, and as such, he would have a territory. When he wasn't bringing in girls from South America, he'd surely be trolling for them somewhere within driving distance of home. The money in human trafficking was incredibly good. There was no doubt of that. But Palmetto's Facebook didn't show him spending money on his family or his vehicle, and he certainly wasn't blowing it on fancy hotels. No, a man like Dorian Palmetto was in it for the hunt. A quick computer search pulled up crime statistics for the local area, noting a higher-than-average number of prostitution arrests near a bus transfer station just a few blocks away. If Palmetto wasn't at the Sleep Tight Inn, he was either at home with his baby-faced wife or out trolling. Clark stopped at a Whataburger to grab a sandwich and then ate in the rental car while he drove. The bus station turned up nothing, so he drove around the mall parking lot, thinking and looking for the Durango. He found nothing there either, so he decided to cruise by the nearby CD motels he'd found through the internet. There were plenty of guys going in and out of various rooms. Hookers hardly ever worked the corners anymore. Sites like Craigslist and Backpage had taken the girls off the street. And when the adult services ads on those sites had been taken down, more sprang up to take their place. It was beginning to get dark when Clark finally saw a blue-gray Durango parked on the side of the road, half a block from the bus transfer station. He made a mental note of the license plate number and then slowed as he continued down the block. A tall Ken doll of a man with perfect black hair was busy chatting up a couple young girls. Clark couldn't see his face at first, but knew in an instant that this was Dorian Palmetto. Surely fresh meat to him. Both girls carried small backpacks and had probably just gotten off a bus. Palmetto paid no attention to Clark as he cruised past in one of a dozen dark sedans, focusing instead on his quarry. Palmetto leaned in close, body blocking both girls as they stood against the brick building next to the bus stop. The taller of the two wanted no part of it and waved him off. She went so far as to duck under his outstretched arm and walk away. "Way to go, kid," Clark said out loud. He fought the urge to drive up and slam the man's face against the brick wall, but consoled himself in the knowledge that that would come later. Sadly, a much smaller girl, likely a runaway and still hardly more than a child, appeared to be interested in Palmetto's proposal. She had short purple hair and a nose ring big enough that Clark could see it from a distance. Palmetto did a lot of talking with his hands, pointing up the street, then opening both arms as if he were offering this girl the world. Or at the very least, a whole lot of money. The driver of a dually pickup behind Clark lay on his horn, forcing him to drive on or risk drawing attention to himself. He flipped a quick U-turn as soon as he had an opening, but the Durango was already pulling away by the time he got back to the bus stop, and the girl with the purple hair was gone. Clark hung back, sipping his Diet Pepsi and reaching into the Whataburger sack to grab the last of his French fries as he followed Palmetto and the girl back to the Sleep-Tight Inn. He got out of his rental car at the same time Dorian opened the door to his Durango. Clark did his best to rein in the hard look he knew he possessed, rounding his shoulders a little and even affecting a slight limp. He was just some random man who'd rented a room, too old to be any trouble. Palmetto paused anyway, giving him a quick once-over. His hand shifted nervously to his waistband, likely touching a handgun. "Nice of you to let me know where you keep it," Clark thought. Palmetto pointed toward number 5. That figured. He'd want a room away from the office, or at least the office would want him far away so they'd have some deniability. The girl followed dutifully, cords to her earbuds trailing down the sides of her face, her head bobbing to whatever music was playing on her phone. She never even looked up at Clark, which made his next move much easier. Chapter 47. The doors at the Sleep-Tight Inn had seen plenty of wear from police boots, so it didn't take much effort with the flathead screwdriver Clark carried in his pocket. He'd anticipated having to make such an entry, and already practiced on his own door. The key would have been slower. Clark rolled a black balaclava over his face and pushed. The screwdriver was still in his left hand, a 9-inch leather sap in the other. Palmetto had just hit the girl hard in the back of the head. She pitched face first into the unmade bed, perfectly framed in front of two tripod-mounted cameras. Palmetto's head snapped up at the noise behind him. Clark's sap took him across the temple, the 10 ounces of lead shot impacting bone and rattling teeth with a satisfying thud. He dropped like a sack of wet sand. Clark registered a flash of movement to his left. He turned in time to see a very large black man with long dreadlocks barreling at him from the open bathroom door 15 feet away. Focused as he was on Palmetto, the attack caught Clark flat-footed, driving him against a wall and knocking the wind from his lungs. Clark attempted to bring the sap into play, but the man was too close, robbing the swing of any power. The man was at least 40 years younger, though with Clark's balaclava, he hadn't figured that out. What he did know was that he was a half a head taller than Clark. Clark exhaled quickly, relaxing his paralyzed diaphragm. He couldn't do anything about the searing pain in his ribs. "You messed up," the man growled, stepping back to have a good look at the little man he was about to crush. "Parrot is about to put a chop on you that you never gonna forget." Clark stopped listening when he heard this guy was Parrot. The name had come up too many times, always in association with a bruised or broken girl. He'd read Blanca Limón's statement, heard the stories about the brutal choppings this monster used to discipline his girls and keep them in line. With his back to the girl on the bed, Clark fainted with his right hand, drawing the much larger man's attention to the leather sap. "Punk ass," Parrot said, and chuckled. "I'm gonna take your little bat and..." Clark wasted no time on words. Bounding forward, he drove the screwdriver straight up through the bottom of the big man's jaw, shoving upward, aiming for the ceiling. The steel shaft of the screwdriver pierced Parrot's tongue and impaled the soft palate at the back of his mouth. His teeth slammed together. His eyes flew open in shock. He made a vain attempt to grab at the screwdriver, but Clark batted his hand away with a sap. Clark pressed the attack, slamming the lead-filled sap into the man's elbow as he fell. Clark shot a quick glance toward a sound to his right and saw a black girl in her early teens peeking around the bathroom door. The fog of battle made it difficult to tell for sure, but Clark thought she had a bloody nose. Parrot gurgled, trying to draw a breath around the screwdriver through his sinuses. Clark turned in time to see the man claw for a pistol in his waistband. Enraged at the sight of a bleeding child, Clark bounded forward, kicking the handle of the screwdriver, driving the remainder of the shaft into the man's brain with a sickening pop. Like his life, Parrot's death was brutal, ugly, and loud. And it was over. Clark spun, dropping the sap to the floor in favor of his 45. He needed to be sure Dorian Palmetto was still out of play. Palmetto wasn't dead, but not for lack of effort on Clark's part. He'd learned long before that knocking someone silly wasn't all that difficult, so long as the possibility of killing them in the process wasn't taken off the table. Palmetto's eyes were closed, and a thin trickle of blood seeped from his ear. But unlike Parrot, he was still breathing. The girl on the bed was either out cold or pretending to be. Clark secured Palmetto's Glock in his waistband, and then, his own 45 held at low ready, inched sideways to bring the bathroom into view, cutting the pie. He found the black girl huddled alone on the floor beside the tub, blood soaked through a bath towel she'd wrapped around her naked shoulders. Clark holstered the pistol and held up both hands. "I'm a friend," he said. The girl hugged her knees to her chest, rocking back and forth, eyes clenched shut. Clark shot a peek around the corner to make sure Palmetto and the girl were still out. They were, so he squatted down to be more or less on the same level as the cowering girl. "What's your name?" She said nothing. "Look." Clark took a deep breath. He was hell at being mean. Tenderness was a little more difficult, so he decided he'd just be honest, and as kind as he knew how to be. These men aren't going to hurt you anymore. Let's get you some clothes.
Clark backed out of the bathroom, not wanting to pressure someone who was already shattered. A few moments later, he had both Palmetto's and the purple-haired girl's hands zip-tied behind their backs. He suspected this one was still pretending to be unconscious, but she was an unknown entity, so he decided to leave her restrained until she came to. Technically, Clark was holding the girl against her will, but compared to the other crimes he'd committed, and those he intended to commit in the very near future, kidnapping a juvenile for her own safety seemed like a minor offense. A quiet voice drew Clark's attention back to the bathroom door.
"Joe," the girl said. "My name's Joe."
She stared, eyes locked on the screwdriver jutting like a gruesome goatee from under Parrott's chin.
"Hi, Joe," Clark said softly.
He moved quickly to cover the dead man with a sheet and then held the heavier bedspread out for the girl. The blood-soaked towel slipped off her shoulders as she took it, revealing an angry burn on her neck. A brand.
"You want to call your mom?" he asked softly.
"My mom's dead," the girl said.
Her chin quivered as she spoke.
"Your dad?"
The girl shook her head.
"Oh, hell no," she said, sounding heartbreakingly like someone twice her age.
"The police, then," Clark said.
Adrenaline from the fight began to ebb, leaving him suddenly sore and exhausted. His eyes misted over as he imagined the horrors the poor kid must have endured.
"Are you a policeman?" the girl asked.
"Not exactly."
"The police stopped Parrott's car twice, you know," Joe said. "But they was always looking for drugs."
She closed her eyes, starting to tremble at the memory.
"Parrott, he just hugged me in close to him and say in my ear, 'You my drugs, Joe. You my drugs.' Them cops didn't ever even notice me, I don't believe. Maybe they think I was his daughter or something."
Clark put the back of a hand to his eye, wiping away a tear, and realized he still had the black balaclava pulled over his head.
"Don't be scared."
Joe shook her head.
"You ain't scary, mister," she said. "Nobody looked at me and cried in an awful long time. Nobody at all."
Joe went into the bathroom and put on a pair of shorts and a loose t-shirt, while Clark examined the camera and computer setup. By the time she came out, he had Dorian sitting upright, hands behind his back, a piece of duct tape across his mouth. On the other side of the bed, as far away as humanly possible without falling off, the purple-haired girl breathed peacefully, fear or embarrassment making her keep up the unconscious act.
"You like music?" Clark asked.
Joe nodded. He'd pulled up some music his grandson liked on his cell phone and connected the earphones he carried for backup communication with other campus members.
"How about Imagine Dragons? Or Maroon 5?
In truth, Clark was just reading off a playlist. He had no idea what either of the bands sounded like. But if his grandson liked them, maybe the girl would too. He imagined she hadn't gotten to make a choice about anything in some time. Joe almost smiled. Clark pulled the only chair in the room away from the wall.
"How about you listen to the music?" he said. "I have some things I need to talk over with Dorian."
Clark put the purple-haired girl's earbuds back in her ears. Hopefully, her music would blot out what was about to happen. He was beginning to fear that something might be physically wrong with her, but she opened one eye, chicken-like, and shot a quick look at him before slamming it back shut again. Across the room, Joe slumped low in the chair, suddenly a teenager again. She looked up suddenly and took out one earbud to give Clark a quizzical look. Her voice was calm now, matter of fact.
"You gonna kill him, mister?"
Dorian gave a muffled cry behind the duct tape. He began shaking all over, eyes wide as saucers.
"No,"
Clark said. "We're going to use his computer to let him call the police."
"Cool,"
Joe said, and went back to her music. Clark ripped the tape from Dorian's mouth and then walked back across the room to retrieve the screwdriver from Parrott's jaw.
It came out with a sickening croak, which only added to the psyops. Palmetto was used to being in charge, the one calling the shots over kids like Magdalena Rojas, Joe, and the girl with the purple hair, finding himself at the mercy of a determined killer like John Clark, had him completely unglued. Dorian's chest heaved with sobs.
You don't have to do this.
Oh, I know that, Clark said, leaning in close so the girls couldn't hear. What I'd really like to do is put a bullet in your brain pan. And to be honest, I still might. But I need some information first. All the air seemed to leave the man.
What do you want? I mean, just take the girls. They're yours, man.
Clark didn't bother to wipe Parrot's blood off the blade, but held it in plain view while he quizzed Palmetto in a harsh whisper about Matarife and Zambrano. Palmetto held nothing back, giving the location of Emilio Zambrano's ranch as well as an address west of Dallas, where Matarife might be hiding out. Clark cocked his head to one side, holding the bloody screwdriver like he hadn't decided what to do with it yet. So you're the one who found Magdalena? Palmetto nodded. At this point, he hadn't figured out exactly what Clark's game was. He decided wrong and guessed a member of the competition. Everyone's always looking for a Magdalena. His confidence was returning since Clark hadn't killed them yet. I gave her mother $5,000. She has two other daughters, though. I'm happy to put you in touch. Clark pressed the business end of the screwdriver against Palmetto's thigh and leaned in, feeling the satisfying scrape as the flathead nicked his femur. The man yowled in pain and surprise, but Clark hit him before he could form words. G.I. Joe smacking a Ken doll. Clark grimaced. Jeez, he said, showing mock concern. You're going to want to have that looked at. I'm thinking Parrot might have had a few STDs. Palmetto swayed like he might pass out. Oh, no, you don't. Clark left the screwdriver buried in the leg, but nudged the handle toward the center line, using it like a lever. Palmetto's eyes lit up and he lurched, kicking his foot as if shocked. Felt that, did you? Clark said. That's what we call your common perineal nerve. We should stay away from that. It hurts like a son of a bitch. Palmetto clenched his jaw and nodded quickly. Where is Magdalena now?
Zambrano, he said. I heard he won her at auction.
Isn't he the boss?
Yes,
Palmetto said, biting his lip. His eyelids fluttered.
I think he bought her as a present for Chin.
Clark moved the screwdriver involuntarily at that, scraping bone again.
Stop!
Both girls looked up, and then just as quickly turned away. Why give a present to Chen?
She's his girlfriend.
Chen's male.
Not Vincent,
Palmetto said, hyperventilating now.
Lily, his sister. Like I told you, she's Zambrano's partner. Brings triad money and muscle into the cartel.
Clark withdrew the screwdriver. So Vincent Chen had a sister. This was all beginning to make sense. Not complete sense, but at least the pieces were starting to fall into place. Lily Chen would possess information on her brother and his business dealings that would help Ding and the others. That was plenty enough reason to hunt her down. Clark shot a glance at the two girls, one of them branded and raped, the other having only narrowly avoided the same fate. He'd never admit it. Not even to himself. But he didn't need another reason. Let's have the password for your computer, he said. Palmetto clenched his eyes shut, pressing tears through the lashes.
It's unlocked.
I'm working with geniuses here, Clark said. He used Dorian's cell phone to call the Fort Worth Police Department vice section and requested an email address to which he could make a video confession. He'd made enough Skype calls to his wife and grandson that it was a fairly simple matter to put through a video call. Even for him. Joe and the other girl listened to their music, eyes closed.
Clark stood just off camera with the bloody screwdriver as Dorian Palmetto began to spill his guts to the female detective with the Fort Worth Police Department. He couldn't help grinning behind the black balaclava. Vengeance shouldn't feel this good. But it did. He looked at his watch. The coppers would be tracing the computer's IP address and should be here in short order. Time to make a call. Chapter 48. Yukiko's GSM listening device had been completely silent for the last hour and a half. Jack Ryan Jr. leaned back in the love seat with both hands behind his head. The Japanese woman sat beside him, gazing forward in a thousand-yard stare, deep in thought. Chavez snored softly a few feet away. Adara and Midas were sacked out on the unmade bed. "You okay?" Jack asked. He didn't whisper. That would have woken everyone in the room. Instead, he kept his voice low and unthreatening. Yuki nodded. "I am. Thank you for asking." "Maybe we should wake one of them," Jack said. "Give you a break." "Let them sleep," Yuki said. "I am not tired." "I know what you mean." Jack found himself wanting to talk to this woman. She smelled good. That was something he hadn't paid attention to in a long time. He paused for a beat, then asked, "How long have you been on the job?" "A while," she said. What else could she say? Jack's answer would have been just as ambiguous, and he felt stupid for asking such a pointed question. If she was angry, she didn't show it. "My father was on the job, as you say. I grew up not knowing what he did for some time, only that his job took him away a great deal." Jack could understand that, but he just gave her what he hoped was a sympathetic smile. "I hardly knew him, really," she continued, "but I thought him an honorable man. My final year of university, my father took me to climb Fujisan. If you do not climb it once, they say, you are not Japanese." She smiled. "If you climb it twice, they say you are a fool. Anyway, halfway up the mountain, we passed a small handicapped man being harassed by two other, much larger teenagers. My father urged me to continue walking and forget about the poor soul. He said we should not get involved in other people's lives, and then recited a proverb that I will never forget. Chakoniku kyoshoku. The weak are meat, the strong eat." I knew my father had taught me better than that. But on that day, I saw the truth. He was a coward. I told him that I had never been so ashamed. But my father was not sad. He merely smiled at my anger and then turned back to confront the bullies. I had never before seen him in a physical fight, and I must say that it was quite impressive. "It was a test," Ryan mused. "Just so," Yuki said. "My father had given me an out with this unplanned situation. Had I been silent, I am certain he still would have gone back to assist the poor man. But he never would have let me inside, invited me to follow him in his chosen calling. That is what he called this work, a calling. It was never a job to him." "That's a good observation," Ryan said. "My father very much liked your American idea of a sheepdog protecting the weak. I am sure he wished he would have had a son." "I doubt that," Ryan said. "I'd like to meet your father." Yuki gave a solemn nod. "Sadly, he passed away last..." She paused, focused on the cell phone in the center of the coffee table. An audible click said the GSM bug had activated at the other end of the line. Hushed voices rose above a hiss of static. A female spoke in broken Chinese. "That is Kim Soo," Yuki said, whispering, though she did not need to. She leaned forward to listen intently. Chavez and Adara sat up in their respective sleeping spots, as if programmed to rouse at the sound of static. Amanda Salazar wailed in Spanish, vowing revenge for the death of her friend Beatriz. Chavez translated. Apparently none of them knew who had pulled the trigger. No one had seen someone named Matias since earlier that day.
He and his machete were both missing. Amanda said she had never trusted him. He certainly had something to do with Beatrice's murder. Several men began to speak at once, this time in Mandarin. Kim Soo's voice came over the phone again, louder than the rest, probably nearer the mics. From her tone, it sounded as if she was flirting with one of the men. Jack waited for someone to translate. Yuki suddenly looked up at him. She started to speak, but Midas beat her to the punch. "They're going to Japan," he said. The conversation continued for another 10 minutes, along with the clank of silverware and the slurp of someone eating soup. At length, the microphone turned off. The battery may have died, but it was late, and it was more likely that they'd all gone to bed. "So apparently," Midas said, sitting up now, "somebody wants Chen in Japan for a meeting." "What kind of meeting?" Ryan asked. "That is not clear," Yuki said. "His statements make no sense. It is as if his operation was of his own making." "What operation is that?" Chavez asked. "That I do not know," Yuki said. The conversation was too broken. "Chen sounds unsure of himself. This is odd behavior for someone who has exhibited nothing but extreme self-confidence up to this point." "I heard no mention of the bombing," Adara said. "It seems like that's all they would be talking about." "Indeed," Yuki said. "Amanda Salazar has to be involved with that bombing," Ryan said. "I watched her do something with her cell phone at the exact moment it went off. And if she is involved, then Chen is involved up to his ass." "That would certainly seem to be the case," Yuki said. "But all we know for sure is that Vincent Chen plans to return to Japan with Kim Soo." Ryan rubbed his eyes, suddenly feeling incredibly tired. Air Force One would be in Japan in less than 48 hours with his dad on board, touching down right in the middle of... Ryan didn't know what, but it wasn't good. Yukiko was already on her feet. She pulled a bag from the closet and began to throw in her things. "I am very sorry," she said, "but I must return to Japan at once." "How will you get back?" Jack asked. He started to offer a ride on the Gulf Stream, but caught the slightest headshake from Chavez. "My embassy has an aircraft," Yuki said. "I apologize, abandoning you like this." She looked at Jack and smiled. "Perhaps we will meet again, Jackson, under more pleasant circumstances." He smiled. "I hope so," he said. She had little to pack, and her toiletries were loaded and her suitcase zipped in under 2 minutes. She handed Ryan a business card, blank but for a telephone number. "I am not so stupid as to think you will not try to find a flight to Japan. If you work for who I think you do, and you are able to get there in the next few days, please give me a call." She gave a slight bow and then was out the door, leaving the entire team alone in her apartment. "Okay," Chavez said, snapping his fingers at the rest of the team. "She doesn't realize we have our own airplane. I would have offered her a ride, but the fact that we don't have any bona fides as government intelligence officers might have posed a problem when we landed. Better that we go in on our own as tourists. I don't plan to get in the way of the Japanese government, but I'll be damned if I'm going to just sit back and wait to see how this plays out. There's no quick way to get to Tokyo. Our asses need to be on that plane 10 minutes ago." Chapter 49. Nada. Zip. Zilch. No, this was worse than zero. Special Agent Callahan pounded the hood of her Ford Expedition and screamed at the night sky. A whippoorwill answered her back from the line of cedars that grew along the fence beyond the 22 other police cars. The creepy bird was probably confused by all the strobing red and blues. Callahan had read somewhere that whippoorwills could sense death. This one sure knew its business. The cartel guy tied to the tree on the side of Emilio Zambrano's ranch house had been dead a couple hours at least, but not quite long enough for the fire that killed him to burn itself out. What was left of his head glowed like the poster for the Nicolas Cage Ghost Rider movie. His face was unrecognizable. Gone, really. But they'd be able to get one set of fingerprints. The corpse was missing a hand, probably since birth.
That should help to identify him. The killer had wrapped the guy's head in what looked like a bath towel, taking care to leave the area around the mouth and nose exposed so he wouldn't suffocate and die too quickly. One of the crime scene techs said he'd seen it before. They'd doused the towel in lamp oil so it burned more slowly and lit the turban from the top to make a human candle. A slow and extremely painful way to die. Maybe Caruso's scary friend had done this. He certainly had the eyes for it. Callahan was pretty sure he'd whacked the woman in the swimming pool and the dead guy by the grave. Some would call what he did a service, like taking out the garbage. But there were lines you just didn't cross. She would catch him eventually. And that was sad, because he was making a difference. Just hours before, Fort Worth PD had received a bizarre Skype confession from a guy who was obviously under duress from someone off camera. Even conservative Texas courts would throw out that confession. According to the FWPD detective, Parrott Villanueva had been stabbed to death with a screwdriver. Maybe the sobbing confessor had whacked him. Captive girls had been rescued in both those cases. She couldn't help but believe that if the vigilante had killed the one-handed guy, Zambrano's body would have been tied to the tree along with him. Now, this guy had committed some infraction against the cartel. Zambrano had murdered him for it and then vanished. Callahan would catch them both, Zambrano and Caruso's friend. Eventually. She stared at the shadow of the smoldering corpse across the yard and smacked the expedition's hood a final time for good measure. A couple of the Dallas County SWAT guys gave her better luck next time shrugs. Her logical brain said they were only trying to assuage the guilt of her failure. But Callahan wanted to feel guilty. Special Agent John Olson came out of the house on his cell, squinted at all the flashing lights, and then started toward Callahan when he found her. He dropped the phone back in his pocket and approached tentatively. She gave him a hard look that he didn't deserve. What? No ID yet on the dead guy, he said. But get this. Witnesses where that guy got killed up the street from you reported seeing a Hispanic male hanging around just before the murder. And he was missing a hand. Callahan just nodded. Anyway, Olson said, I thought you'd want to know. He shot a sympathetic look to Caruso, who'd taken refuge in the shadow of a big pecan tree on the other side of the ford. Okay, then. I'll leave you guys to it. He turned and went back inside the house. The ranch was about as close to the middle of nowhere as one could get and still be within an hour of the population centers of Dallas-Fort Worth. Rolled bales of Bermuda grass hay moldered in shaggy fields surrounding the two-story brick house, remnants of some prior year's cutting. The gate had been unlocked and open, which should have been a sign that they were all wasting their time. SWAT breached, giving Zambrano and anyone else inside precisely 0 seconds to come to the door since there was a steaming body in his backyard. EOD cleared the residence once SWAT found it empty. FBI forensic techs were inside now, combing the place for everything from cigarette butts to pubic hair. They would find something, they always did. But that took time, and Callahan didn't have much of that. Zambrano could run a hell of a lot faster unencumbered. The girls would be the first things to go, if he hadn't killed them already. The ranch was big, and they'd have to wait until daylight to search for graves. She'd called in the assistance of 25 other law enforcement officers from 6 different jurisdictions, including the DEA, the U.S. Marshals, and the entire CAC task force. 6 of the responders were Dallas County SWAT. Everyone not on perimeter or helping forensics was in the process of slipping off their armored plate carriers or stowing long guns and ballistic shields. They all averted their eyes when they walked through the front yard, afraid they might bring down the wrath of the red-headed banshee. This entire day had been a colossal waste of time. Eddie Fung was still in a medically induced coma and likely suffering from permanent brain damage. Gusano, the other idiot from the steakhouse attack, was also in the hospital, chained to his bed with a leg iron. He was conscious, but badly concussed. His brain hadn't been one of the brightest stars in the firmament even before Callahan had bashed him in the face with a pepper grinder. Neither man was going to be much help. An anonymous tip came in 5 minutes after she dropped Caruso off at his hotel, pointing them to Emilio Zambrano's ranch south of Granbury. The call had led them to this failure. To make matters worse, Magdalena Rojas was nowhere to be found. She'd been here, though. Callahan could feel it. Clark lay belly down on the scrubby grass and loose caliche stone. He'd checked the place for fire ants and other stickers, stingers, and stinkers while he set up his hide. It looked clear, but things changed by the second when you were lying in the dark. This was Texas, and it was impossible not to think about rattlesnakes. There were certainly enough rocks and roots for them, but the night was too cool for snakes to be crawling around. At least that's what he told himself. A wire hung from his left ear, connecting the earbud to the phone in his pocket. He expected Caruso to call him with an update any minute. 500 feet below, down the rocky hillside covered with yucca and scrub cedar, a new Airstream trailer sat nestled under a copse of live oaks. There was a chicken coop and a doghouse, but no sign of chickens or dogs. Clark had been watching the trailer for more than an hour. Dorian Palmetto had lawyered up the moment Fort Worth PD booted the door to his room, but he'd given Clark this address for Raul Pacheco. It made sense that Matarife might try to hide out with his father. Clark knew he should have mentioned this location when he'd called in the information on Zambrano, but the legal hurdles of getting a warrant for one location on a tip were steep enough. He decided he'd give Callahan and Caruso the one that would save the girl while he paid a little visit to Matarife. He had a vague plan of what he would do when the slaughterer showed up, if he showed up. It would take a little coordination, and there were still some kinks to work out. But that was par. No plan survived first contact completely intact. There was no moon, leaving the sky to the stars alone. Even under these present circumstances, Clark couldn't help but glance up. It wouldn't be such a bad life to teach the stars to his grandson, to take the time to look up. His own father had taught him the major constellations. He'd learned the navigational stars in the Navy, Polaris, Sirius, Rigel. His phone began to buzz, the noise pushing him flatter against the ground, though there was probably no one for miles to see or hear him. "Speak," he whispered, kicking up a puff of dirt and dry grass with his breath. Surprisingly, it was not Caruso, but Jack Jr. "New wrinkle," Ryan began, and then ran down the latest developments in Buenos Aires. Clark in turn let him know about Lily Chen and her connection to the Sun Yeon Triad and Zambrano's cartel. "Makes sense why Vincent was in Texas now," Ryan said. "John, I'm thinking Japan might well be about to become a very dangerous place. Maybe we should contact my father and tell him not to go." Clark tried and failed to stifle a quiet chuckle. "Your dad doesn't respond well to mites and maybes. I can't remember a single time when Jack Ryan, Sr. or Jr. listened to me when I warned either of them not to do something because it was dangerous." More serious now, he whispered, "But I'll make some calls and let the Secret Service know through channels that there's a possible threat. I'm sure they'll want to talk to any of those people who were around when the bomb went off in BA. I trust your Japanese intel officer will let her superiors know. Make sure she has the aliases for Chen that Gavin found. With any luck, they'll grab him coming into the country." "Those are only the aliases we know about," Jack said. "I'm not counting on it." "Me either," Clark said, peering into the darkness. "Looks like you guys need to go to Japan. I'll clear it with Jerry." "Ding's on the phone with him now," Jack said. "Good," Clark said. "Don't get in the way of the Japanese. But it sounds like their interest may be with the Korean woman. You guys make Chen a priority." "Roger that." Clark's phone chirped with another incoming call. He rolled on his side to look at the caller ID. "Anything else?" "Nope," Jack said. "I have Dom on the other line," Clark said, and ended the call with Ryan. "Speak," he said again. "Can you talk?" "Go."
Zambrano and Chen cleared out before we got here, Caruso said, left behind a torched body. Probably one of their crew. Clark groaned. No Magdalena Rojas? Nothing, boss, Caruso said.